Test, test. This is David Crippen of the Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. This is January 20th, 1985, and today we are talking to Mr. Frederick E. Hoadley, who is a longtime employee of, who has been a longtime employee of Ford Motor Company, both in design and especially in master modeling. He is presently a design consultant, and his company is Hoadley Associates Incorporated in Dearborn. We'll ask Mr. Hoadley to tell us in great detail, if possible, his career as a master modeler and of his experiences in automotive design. And we'll ask him to begin at the beginning and to detail his experiences and the people who had influence on him as a designer and his experiences in automotive design at Ford Motor Company during a crucial period in their history.
Well, you asked that I should begin at the beginning. Well, when people ask me how did I get involved in this and how did I learn, it's normal that you've attended some sort of art school, and this was always my wish, but I never quite made it. But my father was a mechanical draftsman and mechanical engineer, and he was always developing things and drafting, of course, and inventing things and getting patents. So I sort of grew up with a pencil in my hand.
Where was it?
Findlay, Ohio. And his story is interesting too.
Yes, let's hear it.
Well, briefly, his grandfather and father came from New York State and were somewhat involved at the beginning of the opening of the oil fields in Pennsylvania. And his grandfather, my great-grandfather, had invented and developed what they called a packer for the oil wells, and this was a packing that separated the water from the oil or gas and kept the water out of the oil. They had oil wells would have a tube inside of a tube and for pumping, and so they went through the oil fields and sold these packers as a side business, one of the things they were involved with. Anyway, my father was born in a resort city in New York State at Portageville, which was Letchworth Park, and this is southeast of Buffalo and sort of almost south of Rochester, directly south of Rochester, on the Genesee River, and it's there's a deep gorge that runs through this area, and a state park there, and Letchworth Park. It's fairly well known, especially in those periods of time, as a resort area, and there were many hotels in this village, and one in the park itself, which still operates. And at this site, there were three falls along the Genesee River. The first one being close to the city, and a high railroad bridge that went across just above this falls, and at the end of this bridge there was a hotel, and my grandfather for a period of time ran this hotel, and it's his side business of selling these packers with his father. And there was another hotel. I've got that mixed. My great-grandfather ran this hotel. My grandfather ran a hotel down in the city of Portageville. And there were several other hotels. There's still a hotel, a big old brick hotel, in the city at this present time. The hotel up on the hill near where this high bridge was, I think, it was still there up until the middle 60s, and then I think it was, somehow it burnt down. Anyway, when they discovered oil and gas in Ohio and around Findlay in about 1890, they had what they called a gas and oil boom there. Why, my grandfather and his father decided to move there, so they released themselves from these hotels and moved to Findlay. My father at that time, I think, was 6 years old, but he had a lot of recollections of things he had done as a boy in Letchworth Park and there in Portageville. But anyway, so they moved to Findlay.
How do you spell the park name of
it? Letchworth. You asked me these things, and I Letchworth, I believe. They were selling these packers in the oil fields, oil and gas fields around Findlay. And the gas was such a plentiful, the more plentiful probably than the oil, but anyway, Findlay was inviting various factories in and selling them the gas at a very nominal fee just to get factories to move in there. So there were several glass plants that came in, and a small oil refinery and some other industry that came into Findlay at that time. And to emphasize or publicize this tremendous gas supply that they had, they constructed hoops that ran over the main street of Findlay, and Findlay is 5 miles long. It runs from one hill down across Blanchard River and up another hill to the other end of town. They had these hoops, I think, perhaps every 100 feet apart, and at night they would light these hoops and light the city this way, and they burned off the gas. Well, what happened was, in time, of course, they had all of these factories come in there and built, but after about 10 years or so, the gas started to run out. And they also left the pressure off the oil in the ground, so that the oil may still be there, but there was nothing to give it a push up anymore.
Was this this was obviously an error that they should have foreseen.
They should have foreseen. They had the feeling that the more they burnt, the more they'd get. But it didn't work quite that way. Well, anyway, growing up, Dad was the oldest of four boys, and they got into various businesses. They started out by dyeing fabrics and clothing as a side thing. Mm-hmm. And people used to do this, you know. People didn't have the resources that they have now, and a lot of people made their own clothing. Mm-hmm. The wives, were expected to do this. And so from time to time they would want a dress or a suit dyed from one color to another, so they would do this. And mattresses and pillows were filled with feathers, and so they developed a feather renovating business. And these were the first two things that they had as a business. Eventually, they got into carpet cleaning, and then they started to sell new rugs and carpets and floor coverings, but they were always in the carpet business, and they were in business until early 1970, when they closed the business down.
The last relative part of it.
Yes, my dad retired somewhat before that. He was, I think, about 73 when he retired, but he was born in 83, so that would have put it about, what, 63 or something, maybe, when he retired, 66. During this period of time, there was a machine shop that opened up near where my father lived and where their business was. And he would go there, and the man that ran this was a member of their church and quite a strong leader. And of course, he knew my father's family, and my dad, as a boy, would go there and do odd jobs around. And he became quite interested in the mechanical things that they were building, and so he started working on various things and started drawing. And then he took a correspondence course in drafting and mechanical engineering. And after completing this, well, he did various jobs there. And one of the first things that he developed was a ditching machine. And at that time, they had ditching machines that where they had buckets on a large wheel or on a wheel of any size. Right. And the depth of the ditch that they could dig would depend upon the size of the wheel, of course. They could go like halfway or maybe two-fifths of the way of the diameter of the wheel. And so he devised a method of arms over which chains would run, which would carry the buckets. And the arms could be varied in length so that you could extend a set of arms down into the ground and with the buckets, and you could dig a ditch as deep as you wanted, so you didn't have to depend upon a wheel. And demonstrated this and sold the patent to a company out in Iowa who I think are still building this type of a ditching machine. It sort of became the standard way of ditching machines were built.
Is it called a pony ditcher at one point?
Well, I won't say. I'm not sure what name they called it. I think probably, of course, the patent ran out and various companies build that sort of a ditching machine. But the idea was his, and he patented and he got paid for it. One of the other things he developed, since they were in the carpet cleaning business, and of course in those days everybody had carpets, well, some people had rugs. You notice we don't have carpets here, but it was normal that people had carpets in their houses and apartments. And it was difficult for them to clean them. They didn't have vacuum cleaners, you know. And so he developed a portable vacuum system. And we got a gas engine, a one cylinder, one of these large you've got them over there in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
A large, like, I don't know, maybe, you know, I used to watch, they eventually put this in as a permanent installation in their building, but it was a piston of maybe 18 inches, I'm not sure. It's pretty big anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was that,
yeah.
Foot, 14 inches. And this ran a pump, which had at one end, of course, compressed air, and the other end had vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And he mounted this on a wagon. These two units, and he developed. He bought hose and developed a special nozzle that would swivel and had a handle not really greatly different from present-day vacuum systems for cleaning rugs. And so they would take this and they would go around to people's houses and apartments, and this was drawn by horse.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, was like, I suppose that was around 1900, early 1900s, between 1900 and, I suppose, 1910 or so. And they'd go around the various apartments, and they would vacuum out people's carpets. And then when they were finished, they had he had developed various tanks to receive the dust and dirt, and separator, he called a separator,
mm-hmm.
and to clean the air, so when they would pump the air out, well, the air would be clean.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were finished, well, he would open up this separator and take out the dust and show the lady of the house, the
right.
amount of dirt that they were able to get
they
out of the carpet,
amazed,
you know, yes.
Saw it. Yeah.
So anyway, this was, I suppose that was the first thing he developed, and the second major thing he developed was this ditching machine. But he, through
his... He's on those patents over a number of years?
Yeah, well, no, that was his problem. He didn't, he should have gotten a royalty, and the people that bought this, the ditching machine company, and Iowa that bought it brought a satchel full of money, and I guess they gave him $5,000 for this.
Oh,
they put this out on a table,
mm-hmm.
and he should have asked for a royalty, and he should have had an attorney, and I don't think he did. So he signed off and gave it to them, you know, because he could have gotten royalties on that all of his life, because
yes.
they're, like I say, they're still in business.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. He did many other things. He drew plans for an architect that was building houses. He drew plans for a man that had developed a special system for firing tile and brick, a special type of kiln. And up to that point in time, kilns would, as they would stack them, whatever they were firing, they would have part of the stack near the heat source, of course, and a part of it in the middle, and a part of it further away. Well, as the tile would fire, some of it would be overburnt, some of it would be right, and some would be sort of green. So this fellow developed a system for airflow through the kiln in such a fashion that it would fire the load evenly.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this fellow had the patent, and Dad developed it for him.
Mm-hmm.
He made the drawings and supervised building the kilns, and supervised running some of these, getting it started, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of the things that he did, which was rather unusual.
That's marvelous.
And
all this was self-taught.
Well,
anything
and he had taken this correspondence course, you know,
course.
But he read a lot, and it was, I suppose, greatly self-taught. Yeah, it was
yes.
certainly dependent upon his initiative and creativity and talent. But anyway, this was the background that I had. Well, one of the things...
What was his name, by the way?
Harry W. Hoadley.
Harry W.
An automobile company came to Findlay in the early teens. And Grant, the Grant Automobile. Hmm. And so he worked there for some time as an engineer and draftsman. And they eventually closed that plant and moved that plant to Cleveland, mm-hmm. although they also had a plant here in the Detroit area.
How long did the Grant Automobile last, you know?
I think it must have lasted until the early 20s, mm-hmm. and it may have combined with White. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, yeah, mm-hmm. in Cleveland. If he had gone with them, they wanted him to go with them to Cleveland, he might have, become quite a noted engineer because he was, he always had ideas and mm-hmm. ways of doing things. For instance, when he was a fairly young man, I suppose he might have been still in his teens. They were building a special pump in this machine shop that he worked in when he was a young man, and they had sort of completed it, and it was standing there, and he was looking at it one day, and he went and talked to the proprietor, and he says, "That pump you've got out there won't work." And he says, "Really, Harry?" He says, "Well, can you make it work?" And he says, "Well, yeah, I think so." And, of course, the man knew it wouldn't work. They had built it, and it wouldn't function. And they didn't know why. Nobody knew why. Mm-hmm. So he went to work on it, and whatever it did, had to do, revise part of it and reconstruct some controls of it, and it functioned. But... So he was always sort of the engineer of all the things that went on at this carpet cleaning business. And he developed a system of frames to hold rugs of various size so that you could scour the rugs in plant and size them, which is putting a material, what they call sizing, on the back to give it new body, mm-hmm. and this would hold the the rug in shape. And they had a special rack for standing these up, and a heater, and so they would dry overnight, mm-hmm. and so it would make carpet like new, mm-hmm. or rug, I should say. Mm-hmm. But he was the oldest boy. And the story he always tells is that it would come springtime and everybody was cleaning house. And they needed somebody in his business, his father's business. And his father would always lay on him responsibility of coming back and helping them. And obviously, all the things he did there, they must have needed him to organize and make things work. And so he would go back, and that's the reason he didn't go to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. But
he felt his father needed him.
He figured his father needed him, and, so he didn't go. But he lived at home, and he didn't marry until I think he was 31. And so I guess if he had gone to Cleveland, I wouldn't have been. Because he didn't marry, he didn't meet my mother until like 1913, I guess. And they were married in 1914, I believe. So anyway, I have a brother who was born in 1918, And he became quite, well, known, quite capable in photography, and particularly did a lot of development work in copying and reproduction work, and built a lot of equipment relative to that, engineered and invented, and holds many patents. I was born in 1921, and
In Findlay.
One of the things of interest that my brother developed was during the Cuban crisis, we were in Germany, and he was in California doing various things for some companies there. One of the companies was doing work with NASA. I don't know whether he did this directly with them or through this company, I suppose. Anyway, they had had for some time high-speed photography, and they could photograph and develop black and white film, high-speed movie film, which they would take from aircraft. But up until that time, they had been unable to develop color film, and he devised a system for developing color, high-speed color film, and the black and white film of Cuba that our reconnaissance planes photographed
were exhibited at the UN and other places.
Well, the black and white didn't show anything.
Oh, it didn't.
The color film showed their rocket sites.
Oh, yes.
And it was just at that time that it was developed, this system, and he's the one that did this work.
Who were you working for at the time?
Well, I'm not sure. It was for NASA, the work.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so as a boy, I was always drawing things, and I had quite an interest in art, and I always got... that was my best subject, of course. I always got A in art. But one day in the fifth grade, I brought these things out. Again, not knowing how far back you wanted to go, but
yes.
I dug these out. As they do in schools, to sort of fill space, teacher will hand out copies, you know, of a drawing, you're supposed to color them in. Well, that's what I did. And this isn't dated either, but this was what was handed out.
And then can you explain what that was?
Well,
in visual, in audio terms?
It was a picture of a girl, an outline of a girl, and we had to color it in, and as a filler for like an art thing to do, you know, for the children to do.
Yep.
So anyway, I finished that, of course, in short order, and I turned it over, and...
And what is that?
Well, I guess it's a, represents a coupe of that period. It would have been, this would have been fifth grade. I would have been, let me see, I would have been in about 11. It would have probably been in 1932. It has a grill that looks a little bit like the Chrysler that came out at that time. Hoodlouvers.
A luxury coupe.
A luxury coupe. Long wheelbase, low roof. Narrow windows. It has some of the details that you would find on, certainly the Chrysler, but the Auburn at that time.
That's
and
what
the 29 L29 Cord.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway,
influence.
I do that, and then I went home that night, and I drew some and painted.
Is that your first card?
That's the first one. I did some in watercolor. Then I did. I guess they sort of ran in this order, you know. It was the same, similar design.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the second, and this, I suppose, was the third. And,
how did you describe that one?
Well, these were various colors. The second one is the first one was blue crayon, pencil outline, blue crayon. The second one is a pencil outline and blue watercolor.
Again, that luxurious long hooded coupe.
Yeah, long hood and long wheelbase. Then I do a red sedan. And
similar
style, similar vintage. Yeah. And then a what they called a brougham at that time. Or they had another name. What did they call them? Anyway, a two-door sedan with a trunk.
You're describing now your very first portfolio of
yes, I guess you could call it that.
11 years old, did you say?
I'd have been 11 years old when I drew those.
Mm.
Here's another one that must have been done shortly after. It's a little bit cleaner and has more of a auburn look to it at that time. I know I was quite inspired by the auburns at that time. And still like them.
Yes, Mark.
That period of car.
Were you exposed to these kind of cars in the Midwest?
Well, there were.
Of course, Auburn was just across the state, to in Indiana.
Yes, there were a few Auburns in Findlay. This, of course, was in the Depression. There were a few families there that had money, of course, as any city has.
Is this the remnants of the oil millionaires?
Well,
oil and gas?
Marathon offices are in Findlay. That was bought up, you know, recently. But anyway, Marathon, previous to that name, was called Ohio Oil Company.
Yes.
And previous to that was called Linco.
And you spell that?
L-I-N... I guess it was just L-I-N-C-O, and it was a combination. It was Lincoln Oil Company, and they were from Kansas, I believe. And just what, how this occurred, I'm not sure, but there was a family in Findlay, name of Donnell, which held the, which owned or held the major stock in that company, and I suppose all the way through, even in Marathon, they must have owned a large block of stock.
Mm-hmm.
And the man by the name of O.D. Donnell was the father of that organization and of the family that controlled this. And since his home was in Findlay, that's where their headquarters were. So Ohio Oil, especially during the Depression, was one of the mainstays of Findlay. Findlay had a few varied companies that kept it afloat, really. Cooper Tires is a company in Findlay.
They're still there?
Yes. Sugar beet plant is in Findlay. They're developed a ditching machine company called the Buckeye Traction Ditcher, and they were there, and they had a lot of quite a good size employment. And even during the Depression, there were always construction enterprises going on, and so there are always ditching machines and other machines being built and repair. So there were several companies that were active, and so there was some money there. And
quite a varied automobile dealership. And so as a boy, I would go around the dealerships and collect catalogs and look at the cars and talk with the people, the salesmen, you know.
Right.
And so I've got a collection of self collected catalogs that go back to that period. I still collect the catalogs. We ventured out Saturday, even with my bum leg. I had my cane, which I could lean on, and even though my foot got to hurting quite a bit, I was able to go through the show. And
you went down.
Yes,
the Detroit Auto Show.
Yeah, my wife and son and his wife and my daughter and her boyfriend. So we had a lot of fun going down there. We usually go down. And so I keep my collection up, catalogs, but I've got a lot of other things. I've got books and articles and newspapers and so forth that, again, go back to that period of time. But as far as drawing, this was the first car that I drew, the first cars that I drew. I do have a drawing of an airplane. Which is sort of a copy of a Waco. I guess maybe they call it Waco now, but back in those days, in Finley, they called it Wacos.
Yeah.
And there is an airport in Finley, and my brother and I would go out there quite often and look at these planes. And they had a couple of stunt flyers out there who became quite famous as stunt flyers. One's name was Mackey, and the other was Murphy. And they would go around the country and do their thing, you know. But anyway, I've got this, my own design of an airplane, and I would go to but as place of business, as you can see on the back of my drawings, our carpet
illustrations
in color, very high quality paper, and with excellent paper to draw on, you know. So I would go down to their place of business and take these ads that they no longer needed, and that's what I would draw my things on. But I've got this this airplane, which is, you know, maybe the drawing's a good, I suppose maybe 20 inches long or so, and a cardboard that was maybe linoleum was wrapped in, something. Anyway, and I've got in a nice hand on the side of this airplane, I think my initials perhaps, in 1929. So at that point I would have been 8 years old, and it looks it's a pretty good drawing.
Great. Have you saved them?
Yeah, I got it filed away with some other things. But then, this was also a period of time when they, Campbell was doing his speed records.
So Malcolm Campbell.
Yeah, this was one of my drawings of that period.
Can you describe that in audio terms?
Well, it's a very streamlined form of a record car with the engine mid-set between the wheels, the driver sitting just in front of the rear wheels, the large dorsal tail fin, but a very tapered rear end and a very tapered, almost modern front end.
But when you say record car, you mean the vehicle that set the record on?
Land record.
On the Salt Flats?
Yes.
In Utah, yeah.
Right. And or Daytona. They used to use Daytona back in those days.
I remember Sir Malcolm raced a lot on the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Yes, right, he did, right. Well, these are some later ones then, and you can see the influence of...
You're still in the luxury...
Now, this says 1932. So, I'm not sure, you know, this one says 1931. If that's true, I was 10. This says 1932.
That's pretty good technique for 10 years old.
Yeah. Well, 32, I would have been 11 for sure.
Did your mother and father encourage your tendency in this direction to draw?
Well, yeah. You know, the materials were always there.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was always working at it, even though he was, by that time, fully engaged with the floor covering business and carpet cleaning business. He was always developing something at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would get things out and draw, and my brother did too, of course. And my brother became quite interested in photography and other things, and so we were always busy. Never had enough free time really to do our things.
Yeah.
As a quite a young child, I don't know, I could have been 5, 6, 7 or so. They would, back in those days, you would get flour and sugar in very fine, I guess they were linen bags.
Mm-hmm.
And people would use these to make things. And I don't recall how we did this, but I know my mother and I, maybe it had the patterns, they would have patterns laid out in the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And we used, on one of these that was large enough to make a tablecloth, a pattern of crosses, so it looked like a cross stitch.
Uh-huh.
And by using crayon, you put crayon into this and then you'd iron it.
Uh-huh.
And the color stays in that fabric. And we still have that cloth around here, and I couldn't have been more than, like I say, I don't know, 6 or 7, I can remember working on it, you know. But so she had encouraged me to do other things, so I would sometimes sew something or, you know, make make things. And I can remember back in those times they had mannequins in the Sunday paper, perhaps you
call
this.
Yeah.
So I'd cut these out, you know,
sure.
And the different clothing that the people would have, you know, and all of
that
these things.
Then
they would have a tab that would fold under.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the type of thing that I would do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had a my parents had a an income property, so we always had something living above us, and various interesting people lived there.
Mm-hmm.
One of these families was a Scotch family, a young man that had been in the First World War, and he came to the States and became a candy salesman. So he used to bring down samples of candy, you know, and I was pretty young at that time, and I would go up lots of times and have breakfast with him, and I would sort of have to go up all four to get up the steps, so I was that young, you know. But anyway, he would call me McPherson, and he would call himself McGregor, and just as names.
Mm-hmm.
And well, one Christmas, and I suppose, I don't know, I may have been 7 or 8, he got one of these play clay toys, and the imprint forms, you know, that you could make various forms in your clay. Well, of course, I'd use the clay to do other things. I would make animal or sculptor heads of people, or you know, anything, and I sometimes later on would make portions of automobiles or make little cars into this sort of thing. But we had then another lady that moved in, and she hooked rugs, and she would develop her own patterns, and had a loom for this, and made some very nice, very lovely things. And we would give her our old clothes, you know, that's what they would use. And she would get the different colors from the color of the fabric and the clothes. So anyway, this forms also some background or basis for artistic endeavor.
Yes.
Well, these are some more. This this one, I guess I showed you, so I showed 1932, and shows a little more development. This one says 1933.
And similar
car,
design.
And I guess this is that 1932 one in perspective, which is pretty good, really.
Mm-hmm,
you know, there's nothing wrong with the perspective.
For that time.
For
tender age.
1934. You see a development. In fact, you can see I've erased out and extended the grill forward as was happening.
Into sort of a LaSalle configuration there.
Yeah, or Oldsmobile.
Oldsmobile, yeah.
A little bit of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And LaSalle, the 34 LaSalle certainly was a tremendous influence to me.
Was it?
And I have an original catalog, a small one, but anyway, an original catalog that I got from the LaSalle dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And a catalog, a Cadillac catalog, a tremendous catalog from Cadillac at that time, but. It was a tremendous design.
Were they sold at the same dealership in those days? The LaSalle and Cadillac?
Yes, and it was sold in a dealership. You have to relate this to that period of time, but it was sold in a dealership that was, their showroom was no larger than this room, 20 by 40.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I guess they must have had...
You had about two cars.
Yeah, that's all they had. That's all they had in there. They had a front window, and this was faced out onto Main Street. And later, Cadillac was sold by Chevrolet dealer. Is that right? I think so. And but at that period of time, it was sold by an individual dealer. I don't imagine he sold very many. Well, then I did this sedan and this convertible. And that says 1935. This one says 1936.
Well, how would you describe your technique at that time?
Well, these were line drawings, side elevation, a little shading, not very much shading. But by that time, I had developed this name Champlain, which I call all of my cars.
Uh-huh.
And,
Derived from the lake and the battle
and the man, yeah.
The man, yes.
And, well, I, you know, this was a period of time. I was, again, I was influenced by LaSalle.
Mm-hmm.
So there was LaSalle, there was Cadillac, of course, Lincoln, many cars named after famous people, and certainly cars named after discoverers, DeSoto.
Yeah.
So I felt the Champlain shouldn't be left out. It's a nice sounding name.
It is. It's too bad nobody picked it up.
And then this was a convertible made after that same style.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
Getting a little racy.
Yeah, a little more racy. This one also says 1936.
Uh-huh.
And it has it's a little more individualistic, I suppose.
Now, these are amalgams of the various things that you saw and read about at the time.
I suppose, plus my own ideas.
Mm, true, yeah.
And so it's becoming this point, I suppose, more a unique form, a more arrow,
uh-huh.
which I was always interested in, more a little more soft.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did, so then I started developing what it should be mechanically. So you
by this time, are you in high school?
Yes, this is 37, so in 37, if that's a 37 model, I would have been, this would have been the fall of 36. So I suppose I was 15, and...
Was there a curriculum in the Finley school system that allowed you to develop this talent that you had, in terms of art or mechanical drawing or whatever?
Well, they had, up through junior high, they had an art teacher from the high school that would come around to the grade schools, and I think through junior high too, although I don't recall for sure about junior high. I know the art teacher would come around like one day, it wasn't very often, one day at least, maybe in a 6-week period, it would be as often as she'd be able to make the rounds. She would have her daily art classes in high school. So maybe once a month or so, the art teacher would come around. Of course, this was always my big thing. So I always enjoyed that. In junior high, I took what they call manual training, which was basically woodworking. And, of course, learning to read drawings. And I guess maybe we did had some drawing classes there. And so I made quite a few, what they call manual training for 3 years. And I made a lot of things, including a desk in my ninth grade, the last grade in junior high. And I had a rather dramatic lesson one day when I was working on this desk, and I was making the drawer for this little desk, and the teacher, the wood needed to be rabbited out to assemble the drawer. And he, of course, didn't want me to do this on the saw, so he did it for me. But well, here I am, I suppose 15, standing there watching him run his... bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, watching him run his hand through the saw. But anyway, I've always enjoyed woodworking, and I've made a lot of things in this room. In fact, I've designed a lot of these pieces of furniture in this room.
Have you really?
I haven't made them all, but a lot of them I've had built, like this divider. I did all the finishing on that. Those three box storage units I built myself, and for my daughter to put her weaving things in. And I designed and had constructed, but I did the finishing on those radio cabinets. But I've never forgotten this lesson. Watch out for those saws. Well, it was they weren't cut off, fortunately.
He was able to save.
You know, he put his hand in his apron and away he went to the doctor.
Did he save his fingers?
It I think he saved his fingers. I think he cut some of the tendons and, for some time before he regained the use of it. But this was dramatic lesson for me. Well, anyway, this is dated 1937. Of course, by this point in time, Roosevelt had determined that the new automobile should come out in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Up until, I don't know, maybe 35, 34, maybe. He did this early. I suppose maybe 35, fall of 35, they came out with the 1936 models. And beyond that point, the date has always been in the fall. And he did this to give more push for the economy in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose he was advised by his various people that this would be a good idea. The same time, or similar period of time, you know, he moved Thanksgiving up a week.
Mm-hmm.
To give a longer period of time, an additional week for buy for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this would have been done in the fall of 1936, and it shows much more detail than
this
one.
How would you describe it?
Okay, here, this one was dated. I do have this one dated 2/12/1936. So that would have been done in February. I suppose this one would have been done in the fall. Anyway, the body is a single form, and it is developing into some of the shape that I have on this model that I made and hired into Ford. You can see some resemblance in the form itself.
Mm-hmm.
Although this body has no body brake, and I don't have this reverse turn under at the back, I do have the rear wheel covered with a very similar cover. The front has a sort of a nose piece that runs back into the hood.
Does it look vaguely like the Chrysler Airflow of that period?
Well, Chrysler Airflow...
The second or third one, not the
yes,
first one. Yes, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some similarity, yeah. That's true, particularly to the hood.
The hood, yeah.
The front, this tool has separate fenders.
We have one in the museum.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Built-in headlights, mm-hmm. like Lincoln Zephyr.
Oh, yes, yes.
Separate fenders, like the Cord.
Right.
There's V windshield.
Which is still fairly standard at that time.
Yes. I put a taillight up on the body, which Mercury came out with in 38, I guess it was.
You should have sued them for infringement.
Well, here's one called 38. I don't have a date on it either, but I suppose it was done in the fall of 37. And it has a body line, which again this model picks up, and somewhat carrying out the same theme of the front end.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, although these others had shown a running board which was gradually disappearing, this one I had dropped the running board.
Completely.
Mm-hmm.
It was disappearing on the luxury cars, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I guess the next design was this model.
Can you describe the model in audio terms and tell us how it came into being?
One of the things that...
The size first, I guess.
Sure. Well, the size... I don't recall a scale, the exact scale, but the size is about... it's about 18, 20 inches long and about 8 inches wide, 7, 8 inches wide. And...
Would that roughly be a 3/8?
No, I suppose it's more like a 1/10 model.
1/10.
I suppose it could be called a 1/10, although it may have been a 1/12.
Mm-hmm.
But it represented a fairly large car, and it would have had. And I'll read these over because it might be interesting. And it represented a car, a rather long wheelbase. And one of the things that I had developed on my own at this time, which really no car had at this particular time, was what I call full-width seats. The vehicle came out to near the side of the car, like they do, you know, now. And the rear seat was, well, of course, the Airflow had its rear seat, and the Zephyr, Lincoln Zephyr, also had its rear seat in front of the rear wheels, but they were not particularly wide. I took advantage of the width of the body, the total width, and brought the seats on out. So the seats were 66 inches wide, front and rear. So it was like a what you'd call a Davenport in the house.
Yeah,
it was full
quite
comfort.
Unusual for the time, because they used to round them up, didn't
That's
they?
That's right. Full comfort for three people, front and rear. Mm-hmm. Or if you needed to, you could crowd four in, you know.
Right.
But anyway, the motor, I say, valve and head, supercharged, straight eight engine, developing 150 horsepower at 4,000 RPM. Piston displacement was 260.8 cubic inch, bore and stroke 3 1/8 by 4 1/4 inch, compression ratio 6.8. Now,
how does this compare with the large car engines of the day?
I think this was similar at that time. I probably had taken from various things, that this might be similar to the larger Buick 8 at that time. Wheelbase was 128 inches. Height was 67 inches. And again, this had full height seating. You know, there's no problem of your head being squashed. Overall length was 222. Overall width 76 inches, which again, it, even though it had 66 inch seats, this says that there's only 5 inches in width of doors.
Uh-huh.
In other words, I didn't have these foot doors like some of the American cars had. I didn't have it. It wasn't an 80 or an 81 inch width vehicle. It was 76 inch.